I'm Laura, and I am just going to briefly tell you a little bit about what we did, why we did it, and I'm going to sort of preview our findings, because you're going to find that the presentation really spends most of the time looking at the analytical tools and kind of diving into the pieces and how we understood them. If there's a desire in the discussion to come back to the findings and the recommendations, we're happy to do that. But in a sense, this presentation is really focused on the tools. And we have Nora with us, who's leading for Workforce Connections this work stream on labor market assessments. She led an assessment in Lebanon and has been accompanying all of the assessments that we've done. And we're lucky also to have Taka. We have Kira with us, who was also on the team, and she is moderating the questions from the field in the webinar. And we have the team leader and our economist missing. They're both out in the field working on projects, Roberto and Alec. Now, they sang a duet, and we're trying to remember what the song was, but it was in Spanish at a restaurant several times while in Zimbabwe. And we have a video. So for excellent questions, there will be a prize, and you get to see this video. And I'm not sure whether Alec and Roberto would be too happy about this, but we have it. So what were we doing? This was an assignment that came out of actually a training that we gave with Workforce Connections for USAID staff in Bangkok about a year, almost 2 years ago now in February. And there was an officer there, Josh Smith, who's an economic growth officer from Zimbabwe, and he came up to us after the session on labor market assessments and said, you know, we have a program that is coming up for its second stage of funding, and we'd like to make sure it's a little more demand-driven. When the program was designed, it was more during a time of upheaval. It was really more focused on kind of occupying youth that were in difficult situations. It's you know, providing soft skills training. But, you know, I think we need to do some work to really make sure we're aligning with the labor market. And in Zimbabwe, I mean, we're not even sure, are there jobs, right? Should everybody just be thinking about being an entrepreneur? And, you know, could you come and, given some of these tools that you guys have been developing and adapting, could you come work with us? So we agreed to do that, and the team went out this past October. So now I'm going to preview for you what we found in a really global way, just because you're going to be looking at the pieces. We've talked about this and some of our tools as taking a systems approach. And we try to do that, and a number of our tools do that. Our recommendations here were actually not to take a full-fledged systems approach, partly because it's not possible in the context in Zimbabwe. Given number of donors can't work with the government, given some of the sort of serious economic challenges, the major policy constraints, it didn't seem to make sense to have a sort of a big picture systemic type of intervention. But we almost felt that it was possible to work with sort of subsets of the economy. And in most countries, we will do a kind of a sector selection exercise and look at sectors that are growing and then dive into those sectors. We tried to do that, and we did find that there were some jobs and that there was some growth, but we call them pockets of growth. And I'm sure many of you have seen this in countries where you've worked, where there are difficult circumstances. What is a pocket of growth, you know, need to have, or what did it in Zimbabwe? You've got to have a clear market demand and kind of a growth opportunity. You've got to have low policy constraints. This can't be a whole sector that's kind of blocked from growing because of policy issues. It's got to have strong leadership, and in addition to leadership and champions, kind of a manageable group of actors that can collaborate in the value chain, and low investment requirements. And this was key for Zimbabwe because of the cash-constrained economy. So within those, we identified some poultry, timber. You'll hear about a couple more bananas from Taka. And within those, we said to USAID and to the IYF project, which is called Zimbabwe Works, we said, you know, we don't think it's a choice between jobs or entrepreneurship. What we think it's about is understanding these pockets of growth, these value chains, working to kind of knit together these networks and looking at both jobs and entrepreneurship within those. And we'll get into more detail about that later. So with that, I wanted to give Nora the chance to just outline the set of tools that we use when we go do these assessments.
Yeah, so my role today is to sort of step back and give you a sense of the bigger picture of what we do when we do a labor market assessment. And the point here is really to break down what seems like a very complex process into manageable buckets manageable issues, areas of inquiry, and questions. So this is sort of how we've conceptualized the process, again, broken down into steps, and see how those steps fit together. At the top, in the middle, I think, you know, what we generally start with, and this is sort of the beginning with the desk research portion, is looking at what are the country's, you know, broader economic and human capital trends. And then going both into what is the supply of skills in an economy or in a region, depending on the area of focus, and then importantly, what is the demand? What is the economic context? What's really going on? Where are those pockets of growth that Laura was discussing? And then what, following that down a little bit more in depth, what does that imply for the demand for skills within those sectors? We're also, if we look at the left side of the framework here, and at the right side, we're also very interested in looking at what the system looks like. What's the structure of the system? What are the relationships between the actors? And what those relationships or lack of relationships mean for potential for change. Understanding how things function, how things often don't function. And then on the right-hand side, what are those policy levers? Not just labor market policies, but all of the policies that impact the labor market in some way, and how do we understand them? How do we understand how they're impacting the labor market, and what does that mean for what we can suggest and recommend? And then where all this comes together at the bottom is really where the rubber meets the road, right? So this is where we pull all of these pieces of analysis together. Understand what our target population actually looks like, what employers are looking for in terms of skills, how that population may or may not align with that demand, and then again, what are those sort of levers within the system or within the policy framework that we can look at to improve the alignment between the supply and demand within the labor market. So that's sort of the bigger picture. I don't want to dwell too much on that, but hopefully that makes sense that all those pieces fit together. And then again, this is just sort of how we've conceptualized this so far. So this is up for debate, and we would love to hear your feedback on whether these pieces are fitting together in the way that we think they should be. So if we look at the next slide, these are some of the tools that we've been. So this is sort of an open source toolkit, right? Some of these we've gathered from other sources. Some of them we've been developing ourselves. This is being populated as we speak, so this is a work in progress. And we're going to talk about some of these today, and you'll hear more in depth about some of them from Chaka. We're going to be looking at, as I said, some of these buckets. I think starting with this systems and stakeholder mapping, we're going to be looking at, and Laura gave you a little bit of a preview, of the economic structure of Zimbabwe, how it's changed, and what are those sort of areas of opportunity. We're going to be looking at, if you look under supply of skills, we're going to be looking at how people are moving through the educational system and into the labor market in Zimbabwe. And then again, how does that youth labor force actually look? How can we break down the youth labor force and understand their levels of education, et cetera? We, under demand for skills, you'll see there's a tool we're calling value chain analysis with workforce overlay. So there we've mapped a specific value chain in Zimbabwe. It's the horticulture value chain. And with that, we're trying to understand at various functions along the value chain, what are the potential entry points for youth with varying levels of education, in the future, and where we're trying to get there, we're not exactly there yet, but and we'll talk a little bit about at the end about where these tools are going, getting beyond just educational requirements and looking more in-depth at skills requirements. And then there's another piece that we're going to be looking at, which is the what we're calling the entrepreneurship landscape. And, you know, it's funny, we haven't really talked about how this fits in here. I think it might be a little bit of a systems tool, a little bit of a demand tool, a little bit of a lot of things. So I don't know if you agree with that, but that's up for discussion, and we'd love to hear what you have to say about that. So as I mentioned, we're going to be talking more later about where we're taking some of these tools. And we do, under the Workforce Connections Project, we have a number of working groups where we are focusing on specific tool areas, on systems, on demand. And so, you know, as the work of those groups progresses, we're going to be further developing and testing and refining some of these tools. So we'll have more to say in the future about that. But I'm going to turn it over to Taka now, and she's going to tell you a little bit more in depth about what we've done.
Okay. So Zimbabwe used to be known as the breadbasket of Africa. And we see this in the 1970s, the 80s, and the 90s. We had these large integrated firms and commercial farms, and the system was structured around those. So as the economic crisis hit Zimbabwe, the land reform, hyperinflation, we see the system begin to fragment into informal players. Now you have your smallholder farmers and informal workforce. What we're starting to see now is the knitting together of this system, which is the opportunities for growth in the pockets of growth that Lara spoke about in the beginning. And different lead firms are beginning to encourage this. So some of the firms we interviewed, one was Matanuska Bananas in Favco, and they are working with smallholder farmers to improve their quality so that it can be export quality. There was another firm, Hygro Chickens, and they sell day-old chickens, but they actually work with different communities and social groups to help them with implements for the chickens. They even help them with their bookkeeping and walk them through the process until the chickens come to market. So we're seeing different firms and communities starting to create these linkages that were broken apart when the system started to disintegrate. So these are the stocks and flows. The top row in the blue are the educational flows, and this is a snapshot as of 2013 of the education enrollment, right from primary school up to tertiary education level. The next row, the buckets that are in the bottom, are showing the different groups of the youth workforce by educational attainment. And as you can see, we have the biggest group in the secondary education bucket. The arrows coming from the top blue are showing the different groups of youth leaving the system at each level, which then make up the bottom bucket. And then the dotted arrows right at the bottom are showing the youth that graduate out of that group, because we're looking at the age groups 15 to 34. So once you turn 35, you're no longer counted as youth in that. So this is a very useful tool in terms of being able to target the population that we want to work with, or being able to target the different groups with appropriate interventions. It is, however, difficult to get some of this data. We spend a lot of time going to the ministry. Some of the data isn't computerized. But it's very useful data to have in order to be able to see how donors can appropriately answer each group's needs. And then the next one, this is the value chain with a workforce overlay. So it's showing, this is for horticulture, and it's showing the different stages from the rural inputs to the end markets. And the overlay with the different arrows is showing different entry points for different youth groups. So in the diagram below, before, we looked at the stocks and flows of youth in the different groups, and this is showing where the different groups can actually enter into this value chain. We also looked at gender when we looked at this, and the dotted arrows are showing areas where there are lower barriers of entry for women to enter into those different sections. And as we move to the right of the value chain, it becomes a more formal system. But the areas where the most intervention will have the biggest bang for your buck is right in the center from in the small to medium enterprises, where things such as bookkeeping, quality control can help these small to medium enterprises transition into export or into supplying larger markets. And then this is our entrepreneurship landscape, okay, to show the broad spectrum of employment. So there's a lot of entrepreneurship training, and there's a temptation to just lay it out as a binary of employed youth, and then everyone else has to be an entrepreneur. Well, not everyone is an entrepreneur, and they need to be different interventions and targeting the different levels. So as you can see on the vertical axis, we have entrepreneurship capacity. So, you know, there are different elements that an entrepreneur requires, like risk-taking, proactiveness, management skills. So this spectrum is showing right from the bottom, from the unemployed to potential entrepreneurs at the top. On the horizontal axis, we have levels of security. So you can see right at the bottom, we have unemployed. And in red, there are the different suggestions depending on which level one falls in the spectrum. So for the unemployed, it would be better to target livelihood strengthening. And then as we go up the spectrum, we have captive contractors. One of the key informants that we interviewed actually outsourced some of his employees and helped them to set up their own businesses. He's a meat processor. And the employees that he helped to set up their own businesses are actually in a relationship of economic dependency on him, because he is their primary buyer, which is why we've called them captive contractors, because they have one main buyer for their goods. Ideally, those would have more growth-oriented interventions where they can learn their own bookkeeping. He also does their accounting, where they can learn their own bookkeeping and how to access other markets so that they could move to the next block and become independent contractors. Right at the bottom right, we have the deadweight employees who are secure. And this is because labor laws are really pro-employee. So even though they're right here at the bottom and are deadweight employees, they are on the security side because they're protected by the law. And then as you go up the spectrum, you go all the way up to entrepreneurs and successful entrepreneurs. Now, on the top left, we have potential entrepreneurs who may have all the skills to be entrepreneurs, but what they need is more tangible support, such as funding, in order to attain those. So this is just to show the different types of entrepreneurs and employees that are there, and really zone in on what the different groups need.
So this picture represents what we found in Zimbabwe. You could probably draw it for a number of other countries. Some of the slides that you've seen have data behind them, like the stocks and flows. This doesn't have quantitative data. It's a picture drawn from qualitative information and interviews. We are working in Jordan. We're going to try to work with that data and see if in Jordan we can also construct this kind of a picture and have it be a little bit more empirically based. So this is sort of where we think we'd like to go with this. So there are sort of two angles to it. You know, one is how much it actually represents the different segments of enterprises. As we've all known for years, those of us who've worked in enterprise development, when somebody says we're going to work with small enterprises, and that's 80% of the firms in the country, that's not a segment, that's not a slice, that doesn't allow you to really target, right? So what are the ways that we can do that? This was an attempt here. We very much welcome feedback, because I think the area of entrepreneurship is an area that wherever we go, we have people ask us questions about, and we've gotten quite a good reaction to this picture, but at the moment it's only a picture, so we need to kind of move beyond that. One thing I also didn't mention when I gave the preview of our findings, and it's important to be clear. So if you look at the biggest sort of disruptive
piece of what we left behind after we left Zimbabwe. It was a clear recommendation to think beyond skills in terms of the interventions that this project, Zimbabwe Works, was looking at. Now, we left it in USAID's hands to think about whether it's about coordinating with value chain projects that were doing other types of activities or whether it belongs within the Zimbabwe Works project. But I think there's often an assumption that skills are the issue or are the problem. And in some of the cases, what we found is there was a need for skills. We identified what those skills were that were needed. But training may be necessary but not sufficient, or it may not even be the biggest constraint. So that's a kind of an important message that came out clearly in Zimbabwe and that in different contexts may also come out. That has been taken to heart, and as Kristen mentioned, in addition to DFID, so the second phase of this program was going to be co-funded by USAID and DFID, but there's now another donor that has seen the results and the recommendations and is convinced and is also going to be adding funding. So maybe our recommendations were maybe disruptive, but we hope that overall they could bring more resources to the table. And, we'll be interested to follow along and see this next round of programming. In terms of targeting, Taka presented the stocks and flows, and I wanted to just mention sort of Zimbabwe and then compare it to, say, Kenya, where we also did that same diagram. In Kenya, what you found when you drew the stocks and flows and you put the data about the workforce all on one page, it was surprising how large the bucket was of primary school dropouts, those who had not finished primary school, and that it was growing. So one of the things that this does is it's a good tool for national policymakers or for donors who are at the early stages of program design to be thinking, who should we be worried about? In the case of Zimbabwe Works, there had already been some decisions made about the target group, which is a little bit where the Zimbabwe Works program had said we can get the biggest bang for our buck in terms of the types of training that we're offering. And it did seem to match up more or less. We didn't have any quibbles about who they were targeting versus the overall picture of the workforce. But that's sort of what this tool can do. And the other comment I'll make about this tool, as Taka said, this information exists in every country. It's not that hard to get with a little persistence. It is hard to get it all in one place altogether. And even in Kenya, where we got it all in one file and a ministry actually had it, even their file, they were not displaying it in a way that was understandable to everybody, right? There was some weird way in which you had sort of 2 years of education, so it was like 2 years by 2 years, and then you had the Quranic schools and the private schools in a separate page. And so the idea of just kind of merging it all together and saying we want to understand how the workforce is distributed. Recently, we did this in Kenya for doctors and nurses. We did a deep dive of the healthcare workforce at the request of Johnson & Johnson and in partnership with the Workforce Connections Project. So you can also do this for a specific occupation, although that also is going to depend on do you have data. So I think I'm going to stop there because I would really love to give the opportunity to all of you to ask questions and, challenge us to, you are going to say a few words still.
Yeah.
But in terms of, the use of this. Oh, the caveat I already mentioned, which is this idea that when we show you cool pictures, you always want to be asking which of them have actual data behind them and which of them are just cool pictures. There you go.
Yeah, so in terms of where we're taking these tools next, Lara mentioned the stocks and flows. We did just carry out this health sector labor market assessment in Kenya, and it was interesting. And it is hard to get the data. We got the data on the doctors quite easily, but the nurses are not there yet. So any day now, hopefully. So in terms of further refining these tools, that is one way we can do that. There's a lot more that we can look at in a stocks and flows diagram. We can look at gender. We can look at specific regions. It gets a lot more complicated when you try and do it that way. That would potentially be a goal or an aim with this tool. How else are we taking these tools forward? Lara mentioned we're putting data. We're very excited to be putting data behind the entrepreneurship landscape in Jordan, that's still ongoing. But this tool I think gets a lot of interest. People engage around this a lot, and I think that means we want people's feedback on this, and we want to see how we can make it better. One of those ways we know we can make it better is by making those boxes more representational, more proportional. We look forward to hearing your comments on that. Right. So the value chain analysis as well. Here, I think, as I mentioned, we're very interested in taking the analysis beyond just what are those educational requirements, and looking at what are the specific skills, the functions, the processes that actually are underlying those assumptions that you make when you say this is the educational requirement for this entry point. So that is somewhere we hope to be taking that.
Sure. All right, I wanted to add a little bit about this tool, and I wanted to recognize work that's been done by other organizations in this area. There's some excellent studies that many of you may know of by RTI and Duke that look at global value chains and where the market trends are going, and then map to each function levels of skills, you know, high, medium, low, and sort of categorize skills. BAI, back when I was there, had also, and I think they've continued to do some work where they have mapped some, I think, agricultural value chains and also looked at, you know, skills needed and even potentially, you know, what are career pathways. Both those organizations and probably others have looked at something called, you know, bottleneck occupation. So there's a lot to be done with this whole kind of value chain framework and using it to understand skills demand. What we are trying to do is goes a little beyond that and is linked to some of our other work in the Workforce Connections Project, some of our research on the soft skills. We're trying to look at, A, how skills build on each other. So often, and you need, you know, certain skills will better equip you to then absorb information and develop other skills more quickly. And that's something that the current work that exists with the value chains doesn't sort of acknowledge. The second thing we've done, and we did this in a desk study we recently did for Indonesia, is to divide types of skills, not just by the actual skills and the functions, but by who typically would be expected to deliver those. So you have a whole level of what you want to call foundational skills that you're going to expect the public sector to provide. That these are things that, you know, you're going to expect people to learn in school, maybe they are or are not, but those are the actors that you might want to be working with. For example, if you're going to strengthen the vision of those skills. Then, I'm going to skip over the middle. The middle's the fun part. You have on the top, we sort of made this pyramid, you have, you know, on-the-job training that firms will pay for themselves. Now, sometimes you often will find underinvestment in the private sector on-the-job training for various reasons. People think their employees are going to leave. They don't maybe have access to the tools they need to be doing sort of cutting-edge on-the-job training, but there's a sweet spot of training that in principle the private sector should be prepared to pay for, and sometimes it could be the job of a program to kind of catalyze that. Then there's what I call the middle. So it's between what you're supposed to learn in school and what, you know, you would hope that private sector employers would pay for, and it's that kind of entry level. You know, there's a lot of soft skills training out there, but there's also some technical training. There are your classic vocational training schools. So it's a mix, right? It's a mix of public and private providers. There are a lot of NGOs in that space. This is kind of the fertile ground for public-private partnerships. And we've seen those, and they can take the form of kind of an industry-led project, or they can take the form of a regional project or initiative. But that's where we feel like there's room for kind of, how can I say, support to strengthen what's going on in the labor market and to increase that alignment. So, but you actually, when I say there's room, it's sort of, that's where maybe a donor would come in. But you actually need to look at all three, right? And you need to be thinking about, you know, as a donor project or as the government, how are each of these three levels playing out? So all of that is not on this map, and we have some other diagrams, but this is something that we're working on and that we're thinking about. And we really do invite, as Nora said, any organizations that have been working on this or thinking about it to come to our working group, and, you know, we regularly share whatever it is that we've come up with in our latest piece of work, and, you know, ask you all to do the same.